You good?
Yes.
Okay, folks, thanks for your patience. I said 10 minutes, it's been like three, so that's magic like that. At this time, I will call to order the August 8th, 2018, regular meeting of the Ethics Review Commission. We are in City Hall, room 1027, and we will have the city staff call roll, if you don't mind.
J. Michael O'Hurry.
Present.
Peter Einhorn.
Present.
Donna Beth McCormick.
Present.
Louisa Vaughn.
Present.
Deborah Danberg.
Here.
Craig Gilbert is out. Brian Thompson is out. Ben Stratman.
Here.
Mary Kell is absent. And Dennis Spade is absent.
A very skinny, tight quorum is present. Real quick, before we jump down to number one, without objection, I'm going to go down and take number four out of order. Are there any citizens here to communicate not on the Graves-Hidabe hearing and not on the anti-lobbying ordinance? Anybody else here in this very popular hearing that we've held? Going once, going twice? Okay, so we are past general citizen communication. Going to go back up to number one. Unless there are any questions or comments that I need to hear from my fellow commissioners beforehand, we are going to go into executive session. So I'm going off my handy-dandy script here. Without objection, the Ethics Review Commission will go into closed session to take up one item. Pursuant to Section 551.071 of the Texas Government Code, the Ethics Review Commission will consult with legal counsel on legal issues related to the following item. A complaint filed on March 7, 2018 by Jason Hidabe in his capacity as Deputy City Auditor, Office of the City Auditor, against Curtis Graves, alleging violation of Section 235A, Powers and Duties of City Code Chapter 2.3, City Auditor, and violations of Section 2762J and Section 27620, Standards of Conduct of City Code Chapter 2-7, Ethics and Financial Disclosure. Is there any objection to going into executive session on the items announced? Hearing none, the commission will now go into executive session. The time is 6:06 p.m. Okay, thanks for your patience, folks. We are out of closed session. The time is 6:46 approximately p.m. In closed session, we took up and discussed legal issues related to the complaint against Curtis Graves. We are back, and we will now proceed. Mr. Graves, I take it, on the front row. If you're welcome to come forward, or if you want to wait until the city auditor's office is done, that's fine. No problem. What we'll do is we'll have 10 minutes for each of you. During a preliminary hearing, we have no cross-examination. City Auditor's Office is going to have an opportunity to give 10 minutes of testimony, less if they desire, which we welcome. Mr. Graves, of course, will have 10 minutes of the same thing, and then we'll let you all sit back and answer questions from the commission as needed, and we'll discuss from there. Any questions from anybody? Mr. Einhorn, would you be our timekeeper emeritus, please? Perfect. And I've got them here, but I'm saying out loud that I've got signed statements here from Mr. Graves and two representatives from the city auditor's office. So, Mr. Hidabe and Salas, when you're ready.
All right. I'm Jason Hidabe, deputy city auditor. Keith Salas was the senior investigator on this case, and he'll be doing the presentation.
All right. Hi, my name is Keith Salas, and I am a senior investigator in the Office of the City Auditor. And today I'm going to present an investigation that we conducted in which we found that Curtis Graves claimed to be working when he was actually out sick or otherwise not present at work. This resulted in a loss to the city of several thousand dollars. And throughout this presentation, I will argue that Mr. Graves' actions violated the city code's fraud provisions. So, fraud is defined in the city code as the unauthorized use of city resources for personal gain through deception. It is also defined as the misappropriation of funds, supplies, or other city resources through methods including, but not limited to, misrepresentation. Over the course of this presentation, I will show how Mr. Graves' actions violated both of these definitions. I'd like to start by introducing you to Mr. Graves' role in the city. Mr. Graves was the superintendent of system operations for Austin Energy. This meant that he was responsible for overseeing the transmission and distribution of energy for the entire city of Austin. As the superintendent, Mr. Graves had seven direct reports and many more people within his chain of command. As such, Mr. Graves was responsible for providing oversight and supervision to his employees and who's expected to be present at work when on the clock. Throughout this case, I'm going to show you several of Mr. Graves' timesheets, and I want you to understand what we were looking for. On these timesheets, you're going to see regular time written as REG, and this timesheet code is used to show that an employee was working. If an employee was out for some reason, they're expected to cover their time with some form of leave. Every pay period, city employees earn a set amount of sick leave, SCK, and vacation leave, VCU, for this purpose. If an employee retires or leaves the city with an outstanding balance of vacation leave, that balance is paid out at the employee's normal rate of pay. An employee's sick leave balance, however, is not paid out upon retirement. We found that Mr. Graves routinely claimed regular time when he was not present at work and after informing his staff that he was going to be out sick or otherwise on leave. By using regular time instead of vacation time, Mr. Graves was able to build up his vacation balance that was paid out when he retired from the city in June of last year. All told, we identified over 100 hours of leave that Mr. Graves took but misrepresented as regular time. Almost 80 of these hours should have been coded as vacation leave. At Mr. Graves' rate of pay of almost $60 per hour, this misrepresentation cost the city more than $4,700. Furthermore, Mr. Graves was out for more hours than his leave balances would have allotted had he been using them appropriately. Had Mr. Graves used his leave instead of claiming regular time, he would have zeroed out his leave balances and needed an additional 9.32 hours of leave without pay that would have been valued at approximately $557. In order to understand the extent of the fraud, we reviewed Mr. Graves' emails, his timesheets, his badge swipe data, and payroll data. And in upcoming slides, I will show you emails in which Mr. Graves said he would be out, along with corresponding timesheets that show that Mr. Graves claimed regular time for these days. So I'd like to start with the city code's first definition of fraud, which is the unauthorized use of a city resource for personal gain through deception. I've already explained how Mr. Graves' activities resulted in a personal gain to him of over $4,700, so now I want to show you some examples in which Mr. Graves bypassed city policy by having a subordinate approve some of his timesheets instead of a supervisor. And I don't have time to go over all of our examples, so I'm going to start with Exhibit B2 for Thursday and Friday, April 14th and 15th of 2016. So in this example, you'll see that Mr. Graves filled his timesheets to claim 16 hours of regular time when he was actually out sick. So this is an email from Mr. Graves to his supervisor, Danny E., on April 14th, saying that he's sick and will be off today. Here's an email from the next day, April 15th, saying that he was still not feeling well and would be off again. Now, here's Mr. Graves' timesheet showing that he claimed 8 hours of regular time on both the 14th and the 15th. When you see the full timesheet here, please note that Danny E., who is Mr. Graves' supervisor, did not approve the timesheet. Instead, Mr. Graves had Billy Reed, who was one of his direct reports, approve the timesheet. City policy says that timesheets are to be approved by an employee's supervisor and not by their direct reports. Next, I'd like to direct you to Exhibit B10 for October 14th, 2016. So here you'll see that Graves not only submitted an incorrect timesheet, but he instructed one of his direct reports to fill it out incorrectly, and he again bypassed the supervisor. In this email, Mr. Graves said that he was going to be out on Friday, October 12th to clear about 2,000 feet of trees and to fix a mess on his property, and he said that he, quote, won't be readily available. That Sunday, he emails his direct report to tell him that he would still be out on Monday to continue his work, and he instructs his subordinate to give him 4 hours of regular time for the Friday that he was out. Here's a timesheet filled out according to Mr. Graves' instructions. Again, the 4 hours are shown on Friday the 14th. And it is again signed by his direct report instead of his supervisor. So you may be wondering, why was it important for Mr. Graves to avoid showing his timesheets to a supervisor? Well, to answer that question, I'm going to show you a timesheet from May 13th of 2017 that was signed by Mr. Graves' supervisor, Danny E. As you can see, Danny E. had concerns with Mr. Graves' timesheets and was actually participating in a personnel investigation by their human resources team that was independent of our investigation to address these issues. Danny E. only signed the timesheet after writing a note saying, quote, "I am signing this as Pam Wade," and Pam Wade is their HR liaison, says, "it's okay to sign and fix it later. There is a discrepancy and under review with other weeks." Now, I would like to discuss the part of city code that defines fraud as the misappropriation of funds through misrepresentation. In both of the examples above, we have shown that Mr. Graves misrepresented his time, but here's one more example. This example is from March 31st of 2017, and it's exhibit B15. So on that morning, Mr. Graves emailed his supervisor and a direct report to tell them that he would need to be off in the morning to fix his fence. About 20 minutes later, Mr. Graves realized that a half day was not going to be enough time to fix his fence, and he tells another one of his direct reports, quote, "I was originally scheduled off half a day today, but will be off all day now to repair my fence someone ran into last night." However, Mr. Graves' timesheets suggest that he worked 6 hours. When we reviewed his worksite's badge and data, there was no evidence that Mr. Graves ever came to work that day. So what was Mr. Graves doing if he was not physically at work? Well, when we spoke to him, he said that he was monitoring his phone and emails, but after repeated requests to Mr. Graves, he did not provide us with phone records to support his testimony. We did, however, find limited evidence that Mr. Graves was monitoring his emails on the dates in question. In addition to the emails presented at the table at the beginning of Exhibit B, I would like to inform you that the city's Computer and Technology Management Department experienced a technical issue in compiling Mr. Graves' emails for us. As a result, we have identified two additional emails that were not included in the email analysis column in Exhibit B, but we cannot say whether others may be missing as well. Still, the fact of the matter is that regardless of Mr. Graves' email and phone usage, as the superintendent of system operations, Mr. Graves was expected to be physically present at his worksite to provide oversight and to perform his supervisory duties, and he was not doing that. To summarize, by claiming regular time when he should have claimed leave, Mr. Graves misrepresented over 100 hours of leave as regular time, and he accumulated over 78 hours of vacation leave that was payable upon retirement. Upon his retirement in June of last year, Mr. Graves was paid $4,702.26 for that vacation leave. Based on the facts presented, we request that the commission approve a final hearing on this matter.
Time.
Thank you.
Good time. That was incredible timing. Very, very quickly, can you go back to slide 26? I know we're
respondents.
Yeah, I know. I'm just very quickly. We're not going to go into a long thing here. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Of course.
Okay. Commissioners, unless there's objection, I'm going to go straight into the respondent's time. So, Mr. Graves, feel free to come forward. And if you'll, when you start, just state your name for the record, and you'll have 10 minutes. And Mr. Einhorn will let you know when you've got 1 or 2 minutes left.
All right.
Whenever you're ready.
Okay. My name is Curtis Graves, former employee of Austin Energy. So I'm going to tell you the things that I'm working on, what I've requested, and the things that what I would have had to prove for evidence. So I did retire June 30th, 2016. I have requested currently through open records all my emails from the week of each incident that's happened. I've requested Sunday through Saturday. I was as it stated, I was superintendent system operations. My job entailed from when power left the power plant all the way down to customer meter. I was one thing it did not state is I was a 24/7 group. So I had shift workers around the clock, 24/7, holidays, it didn't matter. So I did have employees calling on a regular basis, or events happening on a regular basis, storms, you have, what have you. So anyways, I have requested that. I have not got that back yet. I've also requested calendar, my calendar for that week, to see what meetings I had, what other kind of things I might have had on my calendar. I've also requested the Maximo timesheet program, which is what we entered our time in, because I did notice that some of the timesheets looked altered. So I want to see what was keyed in to Maximo first. So I have requested that. Unfortunately, the things that I don't have that I wish I did, because that would prove without a doubt of the work I was doing, is upon my retirement, I had four notebooks that were logbooks from anything I did while I was at work or when I was at home at work. Upon retirement, all of those got destroyed, along with all my other Austin Energy clothing and what have you. So I do not have that to present. If I was still a former employee, I would have that today. If I knew that there was an investigation being done prior to me retiring, because it was 3 months prior to me retiring, I would have retained all that. Also, upon my retirement, when I put in to retire on a Friday, my 2 weeks notice, on Monday, I was placed on administrative leave for the remaining 2 weeks. So I wasn't even allowed to return to my office. It was standard procedures. They could go on with the process of hiring somebody new and getting them in that position. So there was some stuff left in my office that I was not able to retain as well, including some timesheets that were detailed on what I did at home, what I did while I was at work, when I took lunch, times like that. So that's the evidence that I'm working on, and the evidence I could have had if I, you know, this, some of this stuff is 2.5 years ago. I do have a co-worker. There's only one employee left under my previous boss that's still working there, that was present and may still have the meeting minutes, but would be willing to testify that our boss did give us permission to work at home if you had sick appointments, if you had sick kids, or even if, in my case, I was under the weather a little bit, because I did manage a 24/7 group. We were shorthanded. So I do have a coworker that actually is the one that asked the question to validate that we were approved to do this. Upon looking through retirement paperwork the other day, getting this book ready, I did come across some other evidence that on November 29th, we had a meeting with my boss and HR. It was a standard meeting that he was having with all of his managers. And on November 29th, he brought up discrepancies on timesheets. My previous bosses, because he was not my original boss, my previous bosses said never put more than 8 on your timesheet, 8 hours a week, because it messes the calculation up. Whatever hours you get, if you take off early one day, say sick or vacation or whatever, if you had other hours, you put the 4 hours vacation or whatever it is. There are days that I did work from home. There's other days that I worked late on other days, not necessarily in the office, but if a storm came in, it was expected that I was up all night. I fielded calls from HR, from the VP, from all sorts of different people. I did track all that, and I did count that as part of my 40. On November 29th, I do have a document that I'm willing to make a copy to give y'all that states at that point, November 29th of 2016, that I need to code my timesheet correctly. That was the first time that you put, if you work 10 hours that day, whatever you do, you put it that day. And if you're going to be short, you know, if you're vacation or whatever, you only charge as much. And if you look at the rest of the documentation they have, you'll see that after that time period, there's one instance that it was in March, the March 31st, I think, there was 2.5 hours of vacation. And I think I can recall what exactly what happened that day and why that I charged time. And we actually had a talk with our HR and my boss, which led to a May 17th discussion, to where I basically wasn't going to work more than 40 hours anymore because I wasn't getting appreciated for what I was doing. So when I had that documentation with HR's support and backing, telling my boss that he can't call me when I'm sick, he can't call me when I'm on vacation, that's my time, I should be allowed to use it. So I have that evidence that was stuck in my retirement paperwork and I didn't get rid of. So I'm thankful I do have that. But as far as other, you know, until I get the emails, I can't explain exactly what happened. There's, in y'all's sheets, you're going to see on some days, there was 18 emails sent out. So there was, I think, one day that there was no emails. But there was, most days were 10 to 18 emails that were being sent I have a hard time justifying your job based on emails. There's times that I showed up to the office and never sent an email. Some days I didn't even go to my office door. I had meetings all day and I was in another room. Or I may not even made it to the Austin Energy office. I was at ERCOT or other offsite meetings. So it's hard for me to justify your job based off emails alone. And I am trying to work with AT&T, and that's why I didn't provide them the phone calls before, is because I've had three requests in. You can only go back electronically 1 year. Well, when they requested it, that was out of that year range for me to go back. I have three requests in AT&T, and I've still not received those documents because I could prove some days with text, some days with phone calls. I could even go to data usage, and you can look at the data usage on my phone and see that it was there's things being done. My inbox, another thing, I had an email assigned to me at my house for working at home that my boss signed off on to give me that laptop at home. Now, it didn't work very well, but I had one that was assigned for that purpose. So what I did is I kept about 1,500 emails in my inbox because I couldn't get my personal folders. Anything that I was working, I had easy access to. I could throw it on my TV and I could do it. And that's how I did a lot of work. I had a lot of documents I had to read. My job, you can have one thing happen, and I recognize some of these dates, but I need to verify it. We can make one mistake in Austin Energy and get fined $1 million through NERC. So there was a lot of documents being read. There's a lot of processes continuously being changed. And like I said, I don't have my logs and my notes to validate that because I was trying to be a good employee. And when I left, get rid of everything that was proprietary confidential information. So I do not have that.
Okay.
So that's all I have.
Thank you very much. Commissioners, I'll open it up for questions. Commissioner McCormick.
Who is Billy Reed?
He was my day shift supervisor. He was in charge of the day operations.
Okay, so he reported to you.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And I guess I can't talk anymore, can I?
No, you can't.
Yeah,
please.
I was just going to state on the whole not having your boss sign time sheets. We could look back years and years and years. And in the control room and as well as most shift places, there if the boss typically, like for me, it was always a supervisor. They always wanted two signatures. And previous bosses wanted just somebody to sign that time sheet. It was never enforced to have my boss sign it. It's just like on shift, my employees, if I have a supervisor take off and I have a lead in charge, then that lead signs it, their time sheet. They know that they're there. They know what hours they work. So the whole, that hadn't been enforced in years. When we were told that we need to make that change, we started doing it. But it was until then, that's when we did it.
Go ahead, keep going.
Yeah, but it was not written anywhere that whoever was there could sign a timesheet, whether they were your supervisor or not. There wasn't very good guidelines.
That's correct. I mean, as far as what we're just going off what we're told. My group was a weird group because every week our time was being messed up. The admins would change my shift workers. They would change mine. If they seen, there's times I pulled 24-hour shifts in the control room because a storm was coming in. If I tried putting anything over 8, it threw flags up and they just put it at 8 because I had to be on a rest leave the next day. So when I did put more time and put it's MRL, mandatory rest leave, that threw all sorts of flags, just messed everything up. So we tried doing things as simple as possible, and that's the way that we were instructed for years to do it.
Now, has any of that changed with how the timesheets are done? And I was on 24-hour call whenever, but if you signed a timesheet for 8 hours or something, but I would get called at midnight or whatever, you could always make a note that, yes, I was here, even though I wasn't being paid for that time.
Right. We've never been instructed to do that. I mean, I had my daily logs that I did whenever I had supervisors call on personnel issues. They've called me for, hey, we just had this in the field. One thing one of my guys can mess up and kill somebody that quick. And if they messed up or a crew did something, I was getting the phone call. We would sit there and discuss it. Or I'd get an email or I'd get a text. And then it might take me an hour and I might have to throw a procedure out or something, you know. There's no telling. I was available all the time. I had processes written for me that they would contact me, and I had 20 minutes to respond to a public information office, to key accounts, those type of people. There was processes in place to call me directly for me to handle it, so it didn't contact, they don't contact the guys on the floor because they don't need to be distracted.
Sounds like somebody needs to do a review of job descriptions.
I agree.
One other question I have, the notebooks that you talk about that are gone, were they your personal, you left them here?
They were my, so it's just a personal notebook when you take the meetings and you date it with the people.
And you didn't take them with you, left them here? So, at Austin Energy, was that it? And that's why they were gone? Or
I took one with me, and then a few days before retiring, I cleaned my office. One of those shred bins, it was full when I left. So whenever the next person stepped in my office, it was clean. So the whole office had been cleaned. I had one notebook that had about 100 pages that were doctored up in it from notes and this and that. And I held on to it for about a month, and then I threw it in the burn pile with a old Austin Energy clothes and all that.
Commissioner Einhorn?
I guess this question, I'm going to go along the same line as Commissioner McCormick, but this question's for the auditor's office. In your investigation, did you have any conversations with payroll about why timesheets were accepted without supervisor signature? Because I agree, the practice of having an employee, a subordinate, sign timesheets is hugely problematic, but it's so easily caught by the payroll department. Why were these timesheets even accepted?
And just as a very quick matter of clarity, because I didn't hear an up or down yes or no answer to Mr. Graves, Mr. Reed, Billy Reed, was your subordinate.
Yes, sir.
I heard his title, but just
yes,
to be
sir.
Clear.
He
okay,
was under
got
me.
Perfect.
He
Thank
reported
you.
Directly to me.
Thanks for that clarification. So. Auditor's office, forgive the interruption.
No problem. So we did look into this, and the policy is very clear that the timesheets are supposed to be signed by the supervisor. We did not get a clear answer on why they were accepted without the supervisor's signature on it. That's something that the department would have to do.
I mean, there's some listed on a spreadsheet we have as unsigned. And how long has it been policy that it's a supervisor signature? I mean, is that a long-standing policy, or is that something
sure.
that's changed at some point?
Certainly since I've been with the city.
Which is how long?
5 years, about.
As another clarifying question on this document, the legal size document, which was produced by the auditor's office, the determination of supervisor signature on timesheet, I assume, is yours, because I did not see on any of your slides a printed name underneath those signatures.
Correct.
Okay. So you feel like you had a pretty, well, I see on one you have illegible on one of these, but on the rest of them, you felt pretty confident discerning between Billy Reed and Mr. E?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
All right. One more question. Does the city have a telecommuting policy?
The city does have a telecommuting policy. It does differ depending on the position. So obviously, for example, a lifeguard wouldn't be able to telecommute. In this situation, we had spoken with people in Mr. Gray's management chain of command, and they said that the expectation for him was that he was present for the 40 hours per week, and that if additional phone calls, emails came outside of those 40 hours, that was part of his responsibility as a salaried employee, but they made clear that they expected him to be present.
Can I add on to that?
Please.
November 29th, 2016 is when that expectation was made to me.
I heard, Mr. Graves, in one of your opening statements, you said that you retired June 30th of 2016. I assume you meant 17.
Yes,
no
sir.
Problem. Just wanted to clarify on that. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Apologize for that.
Commissioner O'Hare?
And just so I'm clear on this fact, at any point, and this is, I guess, direct to the complainant, at any point prior to Mr. Graves' retirement, was he made aware either by the auditor's office that an investigation was going on, or made aware by Human Resources Department that an investigation was going on? And if so, how so?
I believe we spoke to him after he had already retired, and I would defer to Mr. Graves about when the Human Resources Department contacted him.
When I retired, I was having issues. I had a couple of employees that were verbally harassing me and threatening me. Upon my retirement, a week after, I still had those harassments and things happening. I even have it recorded, and nothing ever happened. But I called HR and talked to Pamela Wade and told her this needs to stop. I retired. I actually paid money to retire 3 months early. The stress was getting to me because nothing was being done. So I left a little early. Told her that this needs to be done. And upon that conversation, because I knew that there's those same employees have been trying to accuse me for years. One of their brothers is an attorney, and they're trying to accuse anybody they don't like of different things. And I said, I'm tired of this. This needs to stop. I need to know that everything is done. I need to go on with my life, put this behind me, close this chapter. And she said, there is nothing going on. We consider everything closed.
So, Mr. Graves, just so I'm clear on that, it sounds like you weren't made aware by the auditor's office at all that an investigation was going on prior to your retirement.
I was not made by the auditor's office or HR.
And so when you say that you were being harassed by different employees, were you being... Did it ever come up as part of this harassment that you were taking time that you didn't deserve?
No.
Okay. Do you mind sharing what that harassment was
about? I'll jump in and just note that while I think the question is appropriate, it's somewhat not within the scope right. of this conversation. So you answer that how you feel comfortable.
Correct.
I was being threatened verbally, getting whooped off site, catch me outside, whatever. It was basically because we had a theft in the control room. We had, I think it's 8 microphones stolen to record operations. HR wouldn't do anything about it. Security wouldn't do anything. My boss wouldn't do anything. They made me call APD and open an investigation.
Okay.
So I led an investigation, which upset a lot of people that were already upset. So I had APD investigation open, and so I started getting a lot of threats. One of the threats was actually a year and a half, 2 years prior that went all the way up to...
Hang on. So I'm starting to get some concern that there might be an ongoing criminal investigation.
And so, and we'll leave it there. We don't need to go any further than that.
Good.
I want to ask you about this timesheet that included handwriting from your supervisor. So my first question...
Can we ask the auditor's office to go back to that slide?
Yeah.
Thanks.
My first question for you, Mr. Graves, is did you ever see this timesheet prior to retirement? And then my second question for you is actually, could you walk me through the process of how a timesheet is completed and approved? Because I see that some of the numbers are typewritten and some of the numbers are handwritten. Can you walk me through that process? The first question is, had you ever seen this before retirement?
That is my signature.
The blue writing that's there.
I did not see the blue writing.
Okay.
No.
And then just very quickly, can you walk me through the process of how you submit a timesheet and what your understanding is of how a timesheet is approved?
So as far as we go in Maximo, key it in, print it. If there is any altercations, they're having us initial it. Anywhere there's white out or any kind of change that had to be made, we had to initial it, or a supervisor had to initial it. And that was probably the last 6 months to a year that I was there. I would get my timesheet and I would leave it outside my boss's door. Typically, sometimes if he was in there, if his office door was open, I'd put it on his desk. That's the last I seen of it.
So what you're saying is that you would enter it into some type of computer system. From that computer system, you would print out the timesheet.
That's correct.
After it was printed, you would sign it. And if there were any alterations you wanted to make from the printed version, you would need to initial that timesheet. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And the reason that... So the Maximo program, you only had so many days to go back and make changes. And they were requiring us to print our timesheets typically on a Thursday when our time was due on a Monday. So if there was any kind of things that happened on the weekend or whatever, Friday or whatever, then you couldn't go back. Typically, you have to go in and subtract time, add time. It was a bad process. It's a bad program. So they would... you're not supposed to use white, you're supposed to put a line through it, change the number, put your initials by it. And then a lot of times, towards the end, I would hand him my timesheet just to make sure he got it. And before, I'd put it in a stack with the rest of the employees in my group in a box in the hallway, and an admin would come back, and it would be their job to go take it and get it signed.
So this is my last question, and I'll, because I don't want to hog up all the time, but to the auditor's office, is that your understanding of how timesheets were submitted? And if so, did you have any issue with some of the timesheets where there were not initials next to some of the handwritten changes?
So that is my understanding of how it went down in their units. Every city department, for whatever reason, has a slightly different process for doing this. I have no reason to believe that that's not the way it went down. There were some, I believe, that did not have initials next to them. But what we did do is verify in the actual payroll system. It's called Banner. And we confirmed that the times that are showing on all these timesheets are the times that went through the computer system. So that is what Mr. Graves got paid for.
Right. But I guess the distinction would be if the expectation was that any handwritten changes came with an initial. So I understand that whatever is written on the sheet is what is processed and what he's paid for. But what it sounds like is the expectation is that any handwritten alteration also comes with an initial. And I'm not saying that did happen or should have happened, but my question to you is, for the timesheets where there was not a handwritten initialization, did you investigate that further or have any questions about that to try to address that in your investigation?
No, we did not follow up on the ones without initials.
Yeah, I mean, in your very own slides, there's some handwriting that doesn't have initialing next to it. Commissioner Einhorn?
Could you flip back to the slides with the emails? Because in your emails, if I heard your presentation correctly, you use the word off. And in several of the emails, he uses the word out. And to me, those two words mean two different things. And in several of the emails that we have in our exhibits, it says, I'll be out today, but I will be available if needed. And I will be remoted into my computer and will monitor email and my phone. And this is to his supervisor. And so if he was not approved for, you know, working remotely, that would be the time for the supervisor to respond and say, no, you're not approved for that. But did you find any evidence of the supervisor saying, you know, his name is Daniel E. Did he ever respond and say, no, if you're out, you're out?
I think what Keith tried to explain earlier may not have been very clear was that Mr. Graves was expected to perform some job functions outside of his workplace. What he was not approved to do, according to Austin Energy Management, was claim work time for that. That was just part of his job responsibilities. He was expected to be in the office for 40 hours a week because of the supervisory nature of his role, and that there was going to be some additional responsibilities outside the workplace because of the level of the job that he carried.
You don't see it as hugely problematic that there be an expectation that work be performed without being able to claim it as work? I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but I would imagine that there are federal labor issues with that.
There are a lot of job titles that work like that, including...
I would like to, again, I think that there are probably huge labor issues with that.
I would like to make a statement that on May 17th is when I said I'm not doing it anymore, and I have that in writing, because that's what my expectations were changed to, was 40 hours in the office and 20 to however many you needed at home. So.
And is that May 17th, 2017,
yes,
or 2016?
17.
Okay, and then one more question. In Mr. Graves' testimony, he talked about comp time. Does the city have a comp time policy?
Go ahead.
The city does have a comp time policy. I think, Jason, you might know the details more than I do.
I don't earn comp time. I think it only applies to non-exempt employees, which is a certain classification of employees. So it doesn't apply to every job title.
Okay.
Do you know if it applies to Mr. Graves' job title?
I couldn't tell you. I could do that research for you.
Do you want to speak to that, Mr. Graves?
It did not apply to me.
Okay.
It didn't matter if I worked 24 hours or what.
Right.
My expectations from previous bosses were, is you work it out. If you're here with a storm, then you leave early on a Friday. You get your 40 in, unless you have something really present that you need to get done. But if your work's done, you leave.
I guess.
Commissioner Hare?
And trying to understand just how there, if there was a misunderstanding, how that misunderstanding could have happened. The supervisors for Mr. Graves, did he have the same supervisor in year 2000? I guess, could someone walk me through that? In the year 2015 to the time that he retired, who were his supervisors?
I had Jerry Hernandez, and that was in 2012, I believe, is when I was hired as superintendent. I had David Wood. I had Jerry Roberts.
What year was that?
Oh, it changed so much. And then I had Dan Smith. I had, then Danny was my last year and a half.
Okay. So Danny would have been for most of 2016.
That's correct. Until retirement.
Okay. Or to put a finer point on it, Commissioner, here, I think Danny was the supervisor for all of the time of concern. Is that accurate?
That's accurate, yeah.
Okay. And where's Mr. E right now? Can either of you speak to that? Is he still in his position?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
Commissioner Einhorn.
Commissioner Danberg.
Or Commissioner Danberg. Yeah. Shake it up.
In your investigation, did you come across any evidence or information that you would consider to be exculpatory?
Yes, we found the emails. So in that table, there are several emails, you know, ranging from 0 to 18 that we identified, and then a couple more, like I mentioned, that did not come through in the first poll. But that is all we found, and I'd be happy to bring that to the final hearing so you can review the emails yourself and see if that warrants charging 8 hours of regular time. But that is what we found.
And have all of that's been shared with?
Not yet.
That does not go through our office, so we have not.
I'm sorry?
That does not go through our office, so we did not receive that request. But I'm happy to present that in the next hearing.
Lynn Carter with the Law Department. So since the complaint was filed in March, the rules changed in regard to Ethics Review Commission complaints. So I'm not sure. I think the exculpatory evidence provision applies to the filing of the complaint, but I think in all fairness, you're kind of caught in the middle. And so any exculpatory evidence needs to be provided to the law department so we can, and if there's a dispute about that, then we can take it up with the city auditor. But I think there's been a change in the code between the time of the preliminary hearing and the filing of the complaint, and that may require the auditor to disclose exculpatory evidence.
So the requirement would apply to us even though we filed the complaint before the change in the rules?
I think it may, so let's, I know you have your own attorney and should talk to your own attorney about that, but it's something that should be looked at.
We're happy to do that.
And as a matter of practice, that's just based on, not because city code says we have to. I'm telling Jason this so he can tell you also.
So we can all hear.
I don't want to get close to him because he's been. it's basically the full story there. But I think as a matter of practice, we would absolutely include any exculpatory evidence that came to our attention during the course of the investigation.
Yeah, I think the caveat here is we included the details about how many. We include the numbers of the emails. We attempted to include the phone records, but we never received those. We heard about that. I mean, if you need the actual emails, we can provide those relatively quickly. But that would be the extent. The emails would be the extent of it. And all we've done is indicate the exact number of emails each day that we had an issue, and it's on that spreadsheet.
But again, I'm very happy to send those or provide them.
And just for the record, that was Corey Stokes that was speaking. The auditor.
Corey Stokes.
Tell me again what the date was where the note by Danny E.E. was written in blue.
Let's see. That was
May 15th, 2017.
I'm sorry?
Looks like May 15th of 2017.
Yeah.
Is that what I'm reading?
Yes.
Other questions, Commissioner Danberg, before I move on? I'll come back to you, too, if you want to think.
Okay. So that was on May 15th of 2017?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was after retirement.
No, ma'am.
No, pre-retirement, about 6 weeks before he retired.
Okay, it was 6 weeks before. Okay, do we have any kind of evidence that issue was discussed in any of the emails, that specific issue where he handwrote that in? We have any hard evidence of?
The meeting notes from November and May,
mm-hmm.
my reading of those, because I have seen those as well, mm-hmm. I believe that those address this issue. They talk about making sure that his time sheets are accurate and addresses discrepancies.
Okay, and what was the date at which they first started saying that you first heard it's $40 button seat time, as opposed to make these time sheets work out to cover?
November 29th of 2016.
And Commissioner Danberg, I'm not going to put words in Mr. Graves' mouth, and I hope you'll correct me, but I'm under the impression that he's already confirmed that he did not see Mr. E's signature and note as we see here on the slide.
Right.
But I would take it a step further and note that I don't believe he was aware of the review that was going on that we see listed there.
You're correct. I did not see the note, and I was not aware of the review. And yeah. I actually, at this point in time, was requesting for signed copies to be presented back to me. Mm-hmm. And I know I had that copy that was probably left in a folder in my office when I was put on admin leave that did not have that note on it as well.
I would certainly think that I have never worked anywhere that I've had to sign a timesheet where I didn't get either a photocopy or a carbon copy returned to me after its processing. So that's very interesting that the city doesn't return that to employees.
Throughout most of 2017, I had requested that I wanted copies of all my timesheets that were signed because I had my own folder that I was putting them in.
Right. Commissioner Einhorn? Oh, I'm sorry. Commissioner Danberg.
One other thing. Is the city auditor's office disputing, though, that regardless of the button seat discussion for 40 hours, are y'all disputing that he was basically on call 24/7?
No. My understanding is that there were situations, for instance, a Hurricane Harvey coming in, that type of scenario where he may be called in to do additional work. But again, the fact of the matter, as we understand it, is that he was expected to be present for 40 hours a week, and he was clearly identifying times when he was not present because he was sick or on leave for whatever reason to fix a fence, something like that, and charging regular time during those hours.
Okay, and what is your understanding of when the 40 hours button seat regulation was communicated to him?
The earliest communication that I was aware of was the November meeting that Mr. Graves has mentioned.
November 29th,
2016. November 29th?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Commissioner Sober?
So just to kind of piggyback off of that, did the auditor's office review either the employment contract or any kind of initial hiring documents that would have discussed sort of the expectation of time spent on site versus time spent at like ERCOT or offsite?
We did so far, and we reviewed his job description, which clearly says that he's responsible for supervisory duties and providing oversight of the power control room.
Okay. And then so after that, I had questions kind of about the nitty-gritty of what's on the timesheet. So just to take an example, in Exhibit B2 on page 13 of the handout that you gave us, I want to kind of understand what the activity column indicates, because most of the time it's listed as 5810 as the activity code. In B2, it's 5800. I just am curious to know if that... Because, you know, like if it indicates time on site versus time off site, then I think that would be very relevant. But
those are different funding codes. So they're associated with, they're generally associated with the unit and department code and then the different earning codes. So regular time versus sick versus, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know if there's a specific code for ERCOT or something like that.
Okay, got it. And then after that, the only other question I had about timesheets. On page 26, Exhibit B8, one of the earn codes, it's handwritten, and it looks like it says HPT.
That's what I read.
So curious to know what that...
It's a personal holiday. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
It's another type of leave.
I see. Okay. All right.
Commissioner Einhorn was first, and then Commissioner O'Hare.
I want to ask some questions about the administrative leave for the final 2 weeks of your employment. Can you tell us when you announced your retirement, and then how much time between then and when you were put on administrative leave? Were you put on administrative leave immediately upon announcing your retirement?
I retired or announced my retirement on a Friday midday. I can't remember the specific date. It was the 2 weeks notice is what it was. Midday on Friday, I was notified on a Monday mid morning that I had a meeting with HR set up by Dan Smith, the vice president. I questioned what the meeting was about. I'd even have that on an email somewhere. I don't think it was in person. I did contact Dan Smith just to find out what do I need to do to prepare for this meeting. I was told that, have you done your exit interview yet? Because that might be what it is, which, by the way, I still haven't done. So I said, okay. So I met them around 2 o'clock and left my office the way it was, basically, and went in there. And then I was told I was put on administrative leave from that point, that Monday, for the rest of the 80 hours. So it was 72 hours or maybe more, 76 hours. I can't remember what it was that I was put on administrative leave.
You were not told why you were put on administrative leave.
It was standard procedure. They had a bunch of people on administrative leave because of the morale issues in my group. They're wanting to go ahead and get me out and start working on the process to get somebody in. They wanted, because we had morale issues with a few employees in my group. So they thought, is what I was told, is we're going to get you out. Maybe that'll bring the morale up and we're going to get somebody else in. At that point, I turned in my badge, my office keys, and all my personal belongings that were left in the office. I had to get my day supervisor, Billy Reed, to gather up for me and get them to me.
So you had cleaned out your office prior to that?
Prior to this, yes.
Okay.
I knew I was retiring, wasn't telling anybody, and I started cleaning up. So
did his supervisors know that there was an auditor's investigation on the timesheets at the time of his retirement? Was there any effort to go in and collect things from his office, collect evidence from his office while he was on administrative leave?
His supervisors were certainly aware because Danny E., I mean, as you saw in that note, mentioned it. I can't speak to what actions they may have taken to gather evidence.
But the auditor's office didn't seek to gain access to his office to try to gather information?
No.
Thank you.
Commissioner O'Hara.
And I would like to make a statement that I don't believe that they were aware that there was any kind of audit or any kind of investigation going on, because they actually unfriended me for a long time. So when I left, I was wanting to report some of my own stuff that was going on that I thought was wrong, that was happening. And I chose that I wanted to leave Austin Energy stuff in the past. I chose not to do that. They thought that I was doing that, so they were not aware of what was happening, because I have recently spoken to them.
Okay, so Mr. Graves, I do want to understand this, to understand the timeline. You're saying that prior to announcing that you were going to retire, you had already cleaned out your office?
I've been working on it, sir.
And in cleaning out your office, you threw away a lot of, I guess, documents and materials that were there. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that you threw that stuff away because the anticipation was you wouldn't need it for the rest of the time that you were there.
Anything that was old, I kept my current book of notes. Anything that was old that was just in my filing cabinet, there, I'm not going to need it in the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks. So I did start cleaning up the office because I knew it wouldn't be of any use to anybody else. So. The only thing I left was personnel files, personnel issues that I had, like forms that were done. And a lot of that I had on a folder that my supervisors that were dealing with that issue also had access to.
And to the auditor's office, during the investigation, did anyone look at his calendar or try to obtain his calendar and see if there were any appointments on his calendar?
Yes, we used his calendar. We searched emails. As we've mentioned, we requested phone records. We were looking for any evidence that would support that he was working. We provided what we had, which was a limited number of emails that we were aware of. We also additionally checked all of the badge swipe data. So in this facility, you have to badge in and out to verify that he was not in fact showing up to his work site on those days. But we presented everything we were able to find.
So his calendar, because it seems like that's something he's brought up can his calendar be made available to him if we proceed to a final hearing? Can his calendar be made available to him?
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. I did do an open request to have that calendar. Supposedly, they're working on it.
But at this, I mean, you're saying you looked at his calendar. Are you saying just generally speaking, you look at his calendar on each day you went and looked at his calendar?
We pulled his Outlook data that had the emails, so talking about meetings. We can certainly look into and verify all the calendar dates. But I believe, yes, that we did look into that.
And then just make sure we're not missing anything. And this is to the auditor's office. Was Mr. Graves afforded a company vehicle, an Austin Energy vehicle, that he would use while at work at all?
I don't believe so. Is that correct?
We had a vehicle for my department, and I rarely used it.
Can I make a correction on something I said earlier? HPT is actually a paid holiday. HPU is the personal holiday. So HPT, you see.
HPT is July 4th on a Wednesday type thing?
Yeah, okay. What I'm guessing is that's Labor Day.
Okay.
Based on the dates.
Okay. Commissioner McCormick.
I have a question about the calendar, which you said, and he said he has requested it and they're working on it. Why are you working on a calendar? It ought to, if it's requested it in open records, and it should be either there or not.
In all fairness, this request was on Monday of this week. I was just recently given.
Oh, okay.
There's 10 days. On
yes.
Oh, okay.
And I would also assume that wouldn't go through the auditor's office. So.
Okay.
But I would add that we did see in the emails, and again, we can provide those emails. You'll see evidence that he has requested that other people on those days fill in for those meetings.
Okay. Site meetings, I did.
Okay. But I just couldn't quite see why it was so difficult to provide a calendar. Okay.
Commissioners, other questions? Mr. Graves, a couple of questions for you here. So as far as working remotely, I'm hearing a little bit of a, and I'm giving a wide berth here for conversation, but we're not going to do cross-examination. I'm hearing a little bit of a discrepancy in what was, I think we've all colloquially referred to it as a butts in seat policy for 40 hours a week. I'm hearing a little bit of a discrepancy between that and between what was either said directly or implied indirectly to you about what your hours were. Can you talk to me a little bit about your remote work policy? And I'm not talking, just to give some clarity here, I'm not talking about the on-call nature of your job, because I appreciate where you're coming from, and I think that makes perfect sense for someone in your role. But I'm talking more about, in some of these emails, if the auditor wants to flip to some of them, they can, but it's not necessary. In some of these emails, I see things like, I'm out today. I know some that weren't on here, but in our packet, I'm out today. You know, my daughter's going to the dentist, or there's the fence issue, or I'm not feeling well. On any of those, was there any kind of an internal policy, direct or indirect, whereby you were to be on call during those times, and so that's part of your justification for marking that time? Or were those times that you were left alone and you chose to be responsive via email or other things? I know that's kind of a long-winded question, so have at it.
There's not a policy. My job, I was on call 24/7. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just plain and simple what it was.
Right.
But we were at the beginning of when Mr. E came on as a supervisor, we were given at that point permission. There was an issue happening with a meter shop employee where they're working from home every day. And he said, don't do that. But if you have a doctor's appointment, sick kid, you can work from home. And like I said, I'm not even the one that asked the question. Another coworker specifically asked the question. And that's where it was given clarity then, is you are allowed to do this. And so that was what I based my job on. I mean, if I had a sick kid or a dentist appointment, or there was one email where, you know, almost caught my neighbor's pastor on fire, my pastor on fire, told him I was going to be out of the office. I'm going to be at home, but I'm still going to be monitoring and working on my emails. And the only reason why I didn't come to the office that day is because I didn't want my place to catch on fire. Mm-hmm. So somebody needed to be there to monitor in case I seen smoke, but I was still working. And the expectation was that's what I was doing. And that's why in May, well, in November 29th, when the expectation changed, you can see from November 29th, there was one instance that they found that there was what they thought was a discrepancy. And like I said, I'm pretty certain I know what happened on that instance. I don't want to speculate and tell you wrong, but I have a pretty good idea of what it was. And I was up several hours late that night dealing with an issue with one of my crews being an alternate location. But there was that one instance. And then, like I said, in our meeting in May, it's very specific to when I get my 40 hours in, then I'm done. So I had to get more clarification because as they were leading on is your button seat for 40 hours, but you're expected to do all this other work. And I had to get HR involved and say, you're wrong to Mr. E. That is not what he's expected to do. You cannot do that. And I had to get it in writing to say, no, we're not doing that anymore.
And when was that? Because I know you've got that document.
That was May 17th. What it should be.
Okay.
I'll double check. It's in here somewhere.
Take time.
That's what you said earlier, was that 17th.
I just want to make sure I'm not telling you wrong. I'm okay. Pretty positive that's what it was.
And
yes, ma'am. May 17th.
May 17th. Okay, yes. Great. And not when, because we don't know what's going to happen, but if we proceed to a final hearing, I would encourage you to provide as much of that to us as you can.
I would have had this sooner, but
no problem.
It was stuck behind retirement paperwork, and it's a surprise to me. So
yeah, no problem. So I'm a little bit torn because I will say that on the one hand, I appreciate, again, like I said a moment ago, someone in your capacity and the 24/7, 365 nature. That's maybe a little bit dramatic, but pretty darn close to it is what it sounds like, the nature of your job, and how difficult that is to track those hours, especially when it sounds like they were putting you in a bit of a prescriptive box about how to make your timesheet look right. Especially considering that you didn't have any kind of a compensatory time policy based on what we've talked about here. However, I'm torn between that, and I will tell you very candidly, the other side of the coin that I see is, I'll just say it would be easy for someone to conclude that knowing that you were nearing retirement, whether of your own desire and it was that time and you were ready to move on, or because of the harassment you were facing internally, maybe some combination thereof, an easy conclusion that someone from the outside looking in might draw is that knowing that you were going to get paid out for your vacation time, but that your sick time was essentially going to disappear and you wouldn't be compensated for it, that you were in a sense running out the clock. Not implying that, I'm just giving you, hear me out. That you were just running out the clock to essentially get paid for that time while you were off and doing these other things. So it puts us between a little bit of a rock and a hard place on how to discern what exactly happened. I will say in your favor or defense, however you want to phrase it, I think it sounds like there are some very muddy policies above you in the food chain that did not serve you well. I will tell you the bad news to that in some instances, having done this for several years now, is that sometimes those bad policies up the chain hurt people down the chain. Commissioner Einhorn?
I'd be ready with a motion if we're ready for that.
A motion is in order.
All right. I would, I will lay out my motion, then pending a second, I will lay out my rationale for my motion, but I would move that we find that there is reasonable grounds to believe that a violation has occurred, and we move to a final hearing.
Is there a second? Pausing after a second for discussion.
A second.
Okay, so motion by Commissioner Einhorn, second by Commissioner Sobrone.
And so what my explanation is that our standard for a preliminary hearing is reasonable grounds.
Correct.
And I do believe the reasonable grounds exist. I think that once we go to a final hearing, the bar raises, and so... And I think that there's a little bit of a knot here that needs to be untied, but I do think that it's a knot that's worth untying, and I would second what the chair said about muddied policies. There are plenty of muddied policies at every organization. The city should not be excluded from having muddy policies, but I think it's in the process of doing these, we kind of begin to identify these muddy policies. But I do think that the auditor's office has done a good job with this investigation. I think that there's reason to dig in a little bit deeper and better understand this. And you know, my hope is, you know, that in finding these things and finding these policies, that this can be sort of, this can spur the city to clear up these issues. So that's my motion.
Commissioner Sobra?
And just to kind of add on that, I mean, like Chair Emeritus Einhorn said, it's a reasonable grounds basis, but it's also like reasonable grounds based on the evidence that's presented at this hearing.
Yeah.
And I can sympathize that, you know, on such short notice and trying to deal with AT&T and having only just filed an open records request, that you don't have the luxury of being able to present nice binders and like packets to us. And that's a shame. So kind of, again, like based on the evidence that is before us, I think reasonable grounds do exist. And I also think that a final hearing would be an opportunity to present some of that evidence to get a better understanding of what the expectations were.
And I would say that in response to that, the complaint was filed in March. So, I mean, there has been plenty of time to put together a rebuttal. So,
right. Yeah, and I think in defense of the auditor's office, maybe defense is not the right word, the auditor's office is not being thrown under the bus here, but in defense of the auditor's office, I would just say that I think it's important that we all recognize and remember that the auditor's office is duly charged with not putting faces, personalities, emotions, and attitudes into these investigations. Right. Their job is to look at things in a black and white sense and to do these investigations based upon legitimate complaints or what they believe to be legitimate complaints and apply the code or what they know to be the existing code and policies within city departments accordingly. I think that they've attempted to do that. I think they've done a good job. I do think that reasonable grounds exist and that, again, to sort of piggyback on what Commissioner Silverone said, it affords an opportunity to everybody at the table to have a larger discussion about this. And I'll keep my powder dry for my further soapbox about people higher up the food chain and policies that need to be in place, because this is, as most of us here know, especially Commissioners Einhorn and McCormick, who've been here longer than any of us, this feels a lot like yet another case where an existing lack of policy or unclear policy may, and I want to emphasize may, be contributing to a problem here. But again, that doesn't negate the what the auditor's office has brought to the table and that they've done it judiciously. So I think just wanted to say that. Other questions or comments? Commissioner here.
This is just from the two-sided perspective, just to make sure everyone understands the strengths and weaknesses in each of the presentations that have been made. From the complainant's standpoint, it seems that there have been emails that are presented where a person says that they're either going to be off on vacation or sick, and then timesheets that show Mr. Graves taking time where he previously said he wasn't going to take that time. And so I think that's really just the strength of the case. And then in terms of the guidelines that Mr. Graves is supposed to follow, the understanding is that there's a written policy. It seemed like maybe a written policy that says Mr. Graves is supposed to be at work from 8 to 5. To the extent that written policy exists, it hasn't been made explicit here at this hearing, but it seemed like there's some understanding that the application of whatever that policy was wasn't explicit, wasn't clear, or at some point permitted Mr. Graves to work from home. So that's the complainant's argument. As well, there's been a destruction of potential evidence. Now, whether that was done with nefarious motives is unclear. It is clear, though, that Mr. Graves was made aware of this investigation after he had retired. And so the strength of Mr. Gray's statements, arguments, however you want to put them, that he didn't know about the investigation beforehand. He was allowed to work from home had he worked 12 hours in a day, he was not allowed to notate that time on his timesheet at all. And so to the extent that there's misleading statements, it could have been to the benefit or the detriment of the city, but he's being, I guess, punished if it's towards the detriment of the city. And then the other thing is that for whatever reason just hasn't been brought out by anyone. And to me, it's a big point, but I don't think we have enough information to focus on this. But if the handwritten alterations require initials, and none of these have initials, and the last person to touch the statement prior to it being approved and the paycheck being written, how do we know that the supervisor didn't make these alterations? I guess we could simply ask Mr. Gray, did she make these alterations? But, no one responded to that whatsoever, and we were clear that alterations required initials. I mean, one way to respond to that would be to have the electronic input and then compare it to what this written input was. Again, I don't know what the process was. This is what was told to me, was that there had to be initials. So I expected to at least see some of these timesheets with initials. And I don't want to say I don't see any of them, but it certainly didn't jump out at me. So those are the strengths and weaknesses of both sides. I'm not going to state for the dais how we vote, but I do think it's important that all the commissioners understand the real strengths and weaknesses of each argument.
Commissioners, other questions, comments? As a point of clarification, as we all know, we do require a simple majority of our entire body, not just the quorum present, as we know, or the members present. So for an 11-member commission, that is 6. So just making folks aware of that so we know which way things go. There's a motion and a second. Without any other questions or comments, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Opposed? I don't think I heard anybody abstain. Not allowed to. So unanimous 6-0. So we will proceed to a final hearing. 2744D outlines our responsibilities at the conclusion of this preliminary hearing to determine when we will have a final hearing. This is sort of the wonky part of this, where we all sit together and figure out when we want to do this. Our next regularly scheduled hearing, I'm going to look at Sue, is September 19th.
At One Texas Center at 6:30.
Okay, so September 19th. Remind me what you're just showing me. The complainant counsel for the commission and the respondent can all request certain persons and evidence for the hearing. So that's something that this is a good opportunity for. If there are certain things that you wish to have provided to you or people that you want to have here, you can request that. September 19th, any immediate concerns?
I'm concerned with, since I haven't got the evidence yet and I'm going to have a lot of emails to go through, it might take a little bit of time to do that. So I mean, if you want to schedule now, then if I have to try and postpone because I can't go through it all because I've requested a lot of information.
Okay.
We could go to October.
Yeah. I mean, well, and yeah. Were you going to say something?
Oh, I think realistically, whatever it is that the auditors are going to provide through the city attorney's office to Mr. Graves, I think that he's going to need to have several weeks to go through it. And so September doesn't seem realistic to me.
Okay.
The October meeting is the 10th.
The 10th is what I've got, yeah. Other questions?
I work for the auditor's office.
Comments? They're always good. They're always ready.
Right between ACL weekends.
When do y'all think you're going to be able to comply with that as much of the request as you
have that to him by the end of
can
this
week. Be? Pardon?
We'll have the information to him by the end of this week.
Okay.
Okay.
Then now, that's not the open records request. Right. That's just those emails on the spreadsheet.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, my feeling is, if it's a defense situation, I don't know that he should even have to do an open records request. If y'all have been using this to make your case, and therefore you have it.
No, he's already submitted an open records request for other information.
Right, but I mean, the stuff we've been talking about. I mean, you reviewed the calendar, so you've got the calendar, so why not give him the calendar? Things that you have in your possession.
Protection in the Texas Public Information Act. So the emails that are exculpatory and required by code to provide, mm-hmm. absolutely. If any of the calendar items work with that, then we would certainly send it to him. But all of the information that we collected that may not be exculpatory or aggravating for that matter, mm-hmm. we don't provide as a matter of practice because of the audit working paper exception.
Is Mr. Graves entitled to make a blanket request for any documentation that you've reviewed or used for your investigation that doesn't fall under that exception?
Everything that we reviewed would fall under that exception.
Okay.
Could you provide him with a catalog of the information you have so that he can request that information from other sources, that thereby protecting your... I mean, if you have emails or calendar or stuff that is part of your investigative papers...
If he requested his calendar and his emails, then he's covered it. We have the badge swipe data. I don't know if he requested the badge swipe data. But there was nothing responsive in there anyway, so
okay.
Be useful. Anything else I'm missing, Keith?
We also looked at the banner data, which is what shows that the hours he put or the hours that were on the timesheet is what he got paid for.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I do think it would be useful. I mean, if we're talking about what we need for a final hearing, I think the immediate supervisor, Mr. E, should be here to answer some questions about, not just what city policy, but what departmental practice was.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I have a question for y'all, not to interrupt.
Sure.
I am going to bring a few people in for the primary hearing.
You can bring witnesses.
The problem is two of those are still employed and are under Mr. E, and I don't want any kind of repercussions or them to not speak because they're nearing close to retirement, and
they're protected by whistleblower
they're
protected against retaliation.
Right.
We want to stray away from legal advice.
Those employees cannot be retaliated against, and you should feel free to ask for them to attend the final hearing if you want them here. They are protected.
I'm just concerned they may not want to come if Mr. E shows up. That's my biggest concern, because there'll be retaliation.
They're required to cooperate, just like Mr. E is required to cooperate and show up. So they don't have a choice in the matter.
Okay.
We just need their names.
Okay.
They're required because they're city employees. Is that why?
Yes, that's in the city code that all city employees are required to cooperate.
And Lynn, if they want to hear about that assurance directly from you, can they contact you directly?
Yes.
Thank you.
Other questions, concerns? I didn't hear any objection to October 10th. I think there seemed to be some comfort with going two hearings out instead of one.
If we could get any written policies with regards to, telecommuting, comp time, just to see those, that would be good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I definitely want to have Mr. E here.
And then, I'm not giving you legal advice, but Mr. Graves, if you would lay out a timeline and a calendar of when things happen to help us put that in order, that would be very useful for the final hearing.
Okay.
And likewise for the auditor's office. I think seeing things on a timeline is helpful.
Are we here on 10-10?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's what my calendar says.
Yeah, but I mean here, not at One Texas.
In this room? Yeah, we're here.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Just kind of letting everybody get caught up. I saw a bunch of people taking notes. Any other questions concerns, comments? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we'll move on from here. City Auditor's Office, thank you as always. Mr. Graves, thank you for giving us your time.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Yep. Give them a second to step out. Okay.
Space Lysol.
I gave him a cough drop.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to run to the bathroom
before
we start talking about this, please.
Okay, now, is this different than what
we've kind
of
done?
Right, yeah, we do, don't we?
J. Michael, who's kind of the lead on this next item? Is it Deborah?
I think there was discussion about Lynn Lane.
Yeah, Lynn.
Yeah, Lynn Michael.
Lynn Lane,
even better. Okay. Now, is this is different from this?
Yes.
Yes.
And it's different from the other 12.
I see. Is that why
okay, so this
there was
we
a
don't
dash
need.
To
okay.
an office earlier to print out a different thing?
Well, that was to bring my computer.
Okay.
I thought all those people were here.
We got.
No, that's the city auditor's office. They roll deep. They're a posse.
Yeah, but I thought they
any
were.
Any one of us could be here.
No,
that was auditor's office.
You have to know
that
Texas Disposal Systems was going to be the last thing standing.
Oh, my God.
We aren't all.
Mind me later, I'll tell you the whole story.
I appreciate it. You recognize it.
Yeah.
Alumni band's going to be out of your deal.
Distinction weird.
I said alumni band's going to be out of your deal Saturday or Friday.
I'm so
Texas
Exit.
Yeah. I'm an alumni band, but I'm not going to be there this year.
Not as important, but...
Oh, a Hamilton moment.
Pretty hot time of year to be there.
I always feel uncomfortable.
I'm not going to be there this year. I have other things going on.
Oh, yeah, no, sigh of relief.
When the
I've been there before.
Yeah, it's a sigh of relief, but it's also kind of like, has our hearing peaked?
Oh, yeah.
Are we to be made aware that what we're doing is no longer cool?
Right, right. That someone doesn't care anymore.
Oh.
Sure.
I could take the job description stuff and that time.
I can't either.
Yeah.
A few years will just
say. I did job descriptions. I've done job descriptions before. And the time sheets, he always has.
Here's your copy.
What I said.
I know it.
Here's your copy. It's pink or yellow or whatever.
Yeah, ours were always yellow. Senate.
Well, even with. The county is pink because I do elections and it's pink.
I don't look at my time sheet. I've never looked at my time sheet. I mean, I fell out of time sheet, but I've never gotten it back. Not electronically.
I mean, you didn't. We have.
I had direct deposits. So I never ever need to look at.
Yeah, but I mean, for don't you work for the county? Because see, whenever I do election stuff. And we do time sheets, and I get the pink copy, the very last. That's the last. But when I was at UT, I was on call 24 hours a day. Midnight. Doesn't matter.
It's a very, we're not deliberating that case anymore, but, it 2018 is an interesting time, and how, I mean, not just this year, but like this sort of decade, the 21st century and how we work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only going to become more challenging. Right. Again, not talking about our case, but just about those things.
What a time
to be
alive.
The tape recorder is rolling, right? So
yeah. I'm not,
we're good.
No problem there.
Expert communications.
Okay, now what are we doing with this?
Someone I work with told me that.
We're,
let's wait just one more second
for
Commissioner
Gabriel.
Right. Yeah. Someone told me, interestingly, a new lady that I'm working with, and she said, my last job for 10 years, I just told them, I didn't answer the phone or emails outside of 9 to 5. And I was just like, what a concept. Like,
nine to five?
Yeah. I'd love to see how many days I could go without getting fired if I didn't respond to an email or a phone call or a text at 7 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
I had bosses that traveled all the time, mostly.
And work on their own schedule.
Yeah.
And then... My room's not ready. It's Sunday night.
All right, it
my
is.
My room's
ready. It's 8:10, so let's keep rolling here. Let's move into item number 3, new business discussion and possible action regarding the following work group update on draft rules, procedures, and appeals of a disqualification under Chapter 4-8, Article 6, the ALO, as we call it. I think we're going to let Lynn Carter from the Law Department kick us off.
All right. Now, I've already explained to the working group, given my apology, the reason you have a new version, new draft, is that another division of the law department approached my supervisor, and I got word 20 minutes prior to being down here that we need to make some additional changes.
Okay.
So the everything that is underlined is something that you have not seen before, unless you were on the three members in the working group. Commissioner Kale is the fourth member, and she's not present. So what is underlined, the working group saw for the first time today, but otherwise, I'm going to walk you through the whole thing just to kind of give you an overview. So in June, council passed an amendment to the anti-lobbying ordinance, and on the dais drafted an appeal of disqualification procedure that provided a subcommittee of less than a quorum of this commission jurisdiction to hear appeals of disqualifications. That is supposed to be during an interim process while a new procurement code is being drafted. Not sure how long that will take. Staff is hoping that they have a draft done before the end of the year, but then it has to go to council, and it'll probably come back to this commission and may go to other commissions as well. So
Charter Review Commission wants to get rid of us. The City Council wants to give us more to do.
Exactly. What
we're invaluable.
Right.
What changed between the draft last week that the working group first looked at last Friday was that we want to make sure that we carry out council's intent that this be a non-public proceeding. The reason it's less than a quorum is so that it is not an open meeting. There is proprietary information often that's submitted with a bid, and therefore we need a proceeding to handle appeals so that the process itself is not disclosing confidential information. The initial draft, it was decided did not sufficiently protect the confidentiality, so it was decided. So the underlying versions is to even strengthen, to make clear that appeal is a closed meeting and that everything considered in that appeal is confidential unless not confidential under the Public Information Act or by other law. So I think what that means is for the appeal process, it's going to be confidential and there aren't going to be any outside people there. There may be fighting later on about whether records that subcommittee reviews should be public or not. But for the purpose of that hearing, it will be closed. It will be audio taped so that we have an oral recording of it, as well as we'll be keeping records of all documents. And they will be marked confidential. Generally, they are if it's part of the bid. But we're also giving the parties an opportunity to mark anything they want you to consider as confidential and submit it under seal to the staff liaison, Sue Palmer, as part of the filing process. So the appeal per council is final and binding. Per council, an appeal, so bidder gets a disqualification notice. Within 5 calendar days of receiving a disqualification notice.
Five working days or 5 calendar
days? 5 calendar days. Okay. That bidder, the one who's disqualified, must file a notice of appeal. That is all already decided by council. Council said the manner in how that notice of appeal should be prescribed is to be decided by the Ethics Review Commission. So these are the rules. So that's kind of the overview. The second part is the definitions. We're using the definitions in the city code, except for these ones that I've added. The parties to an appeal are simply the respondent, The respondent's the one that got the disqualification notice, and the purchasing officer, unless the purchasing officer has a designee. How that happens is there could be another department that's in charge of that bidding process. So the purchasing officer would say, X department is acting as the purchasing officer. They're the ones that will handle this appeal for the city. They both have a right to be represented by counsel. The notice of appeal procedures are just how it gets filed. It goes to the city clerk, followed by email, by certified mail, or in person. We specified how many megabytes can be sent by email because that system will only handle so much. The confidential provisions are again underlined here. Subcommittee appointments. If y'all want to stop me to address section by section, otherwise I'm going to keep going through each one. Subcommittee appointments. As soon as practical, the commission chair shall appoint the subcommittee of an odd number that's less than a quorum. So right now that's either 3 or 5. If there are problems of getting a subcommittee, you know, together and it gets scheduled and somebody decides they can't make it, basically, as long as we have at least 3 people and it's scheduled, we're going forward with it. Any 3 from the Ethics Review Commission. We're not having a continuing subcommittee because there could be problems with people being available.
And that makes sense. And in practical application, the chair would probably email all members BCC'd with probably you CC'd and say who's available and throw out the line and see who bites.
Or Sue or I will do that so you don't get in trouble with possibly have. You just give us the directive and we'll send out the email. Okay. We will also call, I think, just to make sure, because
expedited.
I know y'all don't have reason to check your emails every day. So we'll.
I used to not have to.
We'll give you, I know, with the exception of the chair. So we will also call to let you know that that we have a disqualification. The anticipated number in a year is
2 to 4.
So that's no guarantee, but that just kind of gives you an expectation. Once the clerk gets the notice filed, she's going to notify the respondent to acknowledge that she got the notice of appeal. She will notify the commission through the commission liaison and the chair of the commission and city attorney and the purchasing officer. So hearing process, 30 calendar days to schedule the hearing, but the commission chair can decide based on good cause that it needs to be extended. One of the specifics we added for good cause is law enforcement may have a criminal investigation and may request a postponement. That was something added by a procurement attorney. Otherwise, I think the commission chair deals with good cause extensions on other Ethics Review Commission matters. The at least 10 calendar days prior to hearing, our staff liaison will provide notice of a hearing just like we do with 10 business days for these ethics hearings. And then at least 5 business days prior to the hearing, the parties need to submit evidence. There is a provision here on the confidential records and then the hearing process under, I'm on page 3, subsection B. It's not a public hearing, talks about the confidentiality. My supervisor pointed out in the working group meeting that she would recommend removing, if you see paragraph 5, confidential evidence at the bottom of page 3, the second, the end of the second line, starting with "in the event a party finds it necessary." Is everybody with me?
Yep.
All the way through the end of that sentence, on the third line of the fourth page of the proceeding, she wants to make her concern is that she does not want either party trying to get ex parte communication with the commission and exclude
another party.
The respondent saying, "I've got to discuss confidential evidence outside the hearing of the purchasing office." Typically, you know, the only confidential record you're going to see is what has been submitted as a bid. So I think that's a fair critique. I think I was being overly cautious with that. I was giving the example to the working group last week. What if someone, what if one bidder hacked into the city's website, got a hold of the other party's bid information, and we needed to not let that party see, but presumably if they had hacked into it, they'd already seen it anyway. So I'll let y'all decide about that.
So what is the, Lynn, what is the potential recommendation for that? Just to take that entire paragraph out, or to
Not the entire paragraph, just that sentence. It's essentially the second sentence of paragraph 5.
In the event a party finds it necessary?
Yes.
All the way to proceeding.
Right.
To the end of that one sentence.
Yes. Presentation, the evidence, it's similar to what we do here, but essentially 15 minutes for opening, 90 minutes to present evidence. The presiding chair for that subcommittee can decide whether or not there's going to be cross-examination. And then closing statements are 10 minutes. I will tell you that as a litigator, I felt like this sounds like really short time. The purchasing office said we always allow 4 hours. They're usually concluded in 2 hours. But then I had a procurement attorney come to me and say, "I'm concerned about this 90 minutes. So it says in here they can ask for additional time. It says in here that one party can ask the other party to donate a portion of their time. The reason I put that in there is the purchasing office said ours is typically written information, and ours is going to be short and sweet.
Yeah.
So if that's their position, they can donate their time to the other respond to.
And it sounds like our backdoor here is that the chair has the discretion to extend the time.
Exactly.
Perfect.
The reason I put confidential conference of the subcommittee is that I thought, just like a jury deliberates, the subcommittee may want to decide that day what their decision is going to be, but they'll need to do it just like a jury does, sequestered. And they can either decide that they're going to come back and give an oral decision when they're done, or they can decide we're just going to issue a written order within 5 days, which they're required to do regardless. The decision on the appeal, written orders will be posted to the commission's website, and a copy will be provided to the parties and the city attorney.
So, am I cutting you off?
Nope.
Okay. I'll jump in right out of the gate and say I made some notes on the sort of pros and cons for moving this forward tonight. I think the obvious con right out of the gate has been outlined by our great staff here by noting that there's been some last minute changes in here and what sounds like a needed change on page 3 overlapping to 4, though as a sidebar, I'm sure that we could make that change and approve it as changed tonight. We've done that plenty of times in the past. And the other con of moving it forward tonight is, while this isn't the
biggest, sexiest, most dramatic thing that this commission will handle in 2018. It is something that is very important and a lot of people care about on the outside. And so doing it with the bare minimum quorum may be less than ideal. I'm coming to you in 1 second, Commissioner Einhorn. The only other counter argument to that is I imagine that council is probably pretty eager to get something back from us. I don't know how long ago officially they kicked this to us.
The concern is not council. Council's role is done. It doesn't have to go back to them. The concern would be if there's a disqualification next week, we would need some rules in place as to how to handle the appeal.
Right.
So we may not get a disqualification for 6 months. I don't know. But if we got a disqualification in next week, y'all would have to have a special call meeting. Mm-hmm. And within 5 calendar days.
Commissioner Einhorn, yes, had his hand up first, yeah, and then Commissioner Denver.
Lynn, sorry, repeat for me the rationale for taking the sentence out in B5.
So the concern was that one party would say, I need to discuss confidential information that I don't want the other party to hear. And therefore, I want to discuss it with the commission while the purchasing office is outside the hearing room, or vice versa. The purchasing office says, I need to discuss this confidential information, and the respondent's not a necessary party. Again, a scenario I came up with is, we were hacked, CTM tells us that, and we have reason to suspect, you know, this party. I don't know what it is, but my supervisor said we don't want to have ex parte. Our procedures allow for one party to ex parte the commission.
Yeah, I'm having trouble thinking of a reason why purchasing and or the other side would need to be out of the room, so I don't have a problem with striking that sentence. But
okay. Yes. Oh. That's not my job.
I see one problem in here that it, these, I know the timing part of this is so crucial, but on page 4 under 6C, a party who seeks additional time to present evidence must request additional time 5 city business days prior to the appeal hearing. But the appeal hearing is on such a tight deadline that by the time they know that they have to present the appeal, they're not going to know yet how long it's going to take them to ask for the extra time. So I'm kind of thinking that we probably need to let them request the additional time right up until the hearing itself. I mean, I know it's inconvenient for the hearing commission members, but we're here to serve.
Yeah.
That's why we get the big bucks.
That's right. I don't necessarily disagree with that, Commissioner Denberg. Yeah.
I don't disagree with that either, but and just as a quick refresher, just make sure everyone's on the same page and knows how this works, because it's easy to forget, but basically what's going on is when bids for some type of item were made and someone puts in what their work would be, and I guess puts in their offer for the contract. There's a no communication period that goes on, and during that no communication period, none of the competitors can either communicate directly with a city council member or anyone that's on the city that could be affecting the decision. If for some reason that happens, the purchasing office is required to disqualify that person from competing on the bid, and they're sent a notice of disqualification. So with that notice of disqualification, that they can't compete on that bid. Now, ordinarily, what would happen is that entity could protest that disqualification, and the purchasing officer could decide to either send that to a hearing officer, or I think there was some other way to deal with that. The purchasing officer would decide which hearing officer it would be. I think there were some complaints about that process. My understanding as well is that ordinarily that process is what is used throughout the nation. council passed this ordinance. What it does allow for is an additional method to appeal the disqualification. The term protest is specifically not used in this draft here because that's a term of art within the purchasing community, like within bids around the country. So that term of art is not used. What's somewhat kind of up in the air, somewhat of an open question, is whether or not an entity could challenge a disqualification either through the protest system and go through the purchasing officer, which had been done normally, and or go through the ethics commission. But certainly an entity would have a right to appeal to the ethics commission, just so everyone understands how this ordinance applies and its significance.
See, I told you should have been the chairman. Okay.
So, and what Commissioner Curry is talking about is, did I keep this copy for myself?
You can use mine. Go ahead.
It's on page 6. It's the next to last page.
So this is different from this. Oh.
Okay. Sue gave you a copy. I just didn't know if you'd have it handy.
Oh, yeah.
So, and I highlighted a version. So, I know. She's way ahead of me.
Yeah.
in a number of ways. So 27109A, that's the new provision that council added on the dais. There still exists C, and so there, you know, is some question about whether someone who's disqualified can still go through the process of seeking a review by an appeal by a hearing officer. Protest is synonymous with appeal. Council used appeal, but protest is what has always been used in the anti-lobbying ordinance in regard to a disqualification. So it's not 100% clear, and there's a possibility that someone would say, we're not going to use the Ethics Review Commission. We're going to use the traditional process that's in place and request a hearing officer. So I appreciate you pointing that out, and I think what we're here about is if a notice of appeal gets filed with the city clerk under our procedures that we're putting in place, then the subcommittee will hear that appeal. And the rest of it will be for the city and that.
Whoever's being disenfranchised has their choice
to figure it out.
Of ways to go about it, it appears.
Arguably, yes.
Mr. Chauvin?
Yes, So if a bidder was disqualified and decided to appeal and did not have any kind of rules adopted, is it just sort of, you know, like, are the parties and the subcommittee kind of left to their own devices on hearing that appeal?
Seems so.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem right now is that there's not, see, it says that the manner prescribed as to how an appeal must be filed must be determined by this commission. So,
right.
Until we pass some rules that at the very least show how to file an appeal, that process is not in place.
I see. Okay.
Is there any kind of a prohibition on communication with members of the Ethics Review Commission from these outside sources?
Good point. I think
outside of common sense.
Well, I mean, I think the no contact provision would still apply outside the hearing process.
Our ex parte provision.
Yeah, I know about our ex parte, but
I don't know that ours.
I'm not sure
is directly
it
applicable.
Applies.
Yeah, I was gonna say. We may want to make that explicit.
That's why I'm asking, and I also think that what you're talking about is applicable to city employees, is it not? And we're not city employees.
Yes.
So we you're saying we should add an ex parte communication provision to
I'm just saying it would be somewhat ironic to jump through all these hoops to have a hearing about disqualifications potentially for outside communication and blackout period communication, all those things, and then have those same people be able to come to Donna Beth and say, hey, can we go grab a cocktail and let me explain this to you, from the horse's mouth. Not that that's going to happen. I'm not saying that's going to happen.
That's a no-no.
Which may give you an extreme example.
Well,
and we have to, not to sound cheesy, but of all people, we have to hold ourselves to the highest standard.
I guess my recommendation would be at the very least tonight that you, at the very least, pass Section 3, the Notice of Appeal Procedures, as the rules until you can do a full set, at least at that point there would be a way to file a notice of appeal within.
But just so I'm...
You could do 1, 2, 3, 4, and hold off on the hearing process.
Because any changes that we have.
I don't mind adopting something as interim and then coming back next month and making and tinkering with it, but we do have some folks who have come, so maybe we should hear what they have to say before we.
I don't get the impression they're just here to soak it up.
It's the assistant.
Not even saying yes, just head nods.
That's how much they don't want it.
Yeah, I see nothing unripe about 1, 2, 3, 4. So I do think that we could pass that. We've looked at that. It seems really clean, and the only places where I see any issue is on page 3, hearing process B3, that respondent's right to open and close. I think I've gotten that cleared up in my head, that even though it's a confidential hearing, the respondent could say, I want the opening and closing statement to be public, and then go into the confidential parts with the documentation and stuff like that. Then the part about confidential evidence at the bottom there that we'd be scratching, we'll need to come up with some ex parte language that's specific in here. And then take out that part on page 4,
three
presentation
four.
Of evidence about the five business day notice for a request to ask for extra time. So if everybody agrees with that, I would make a motion, if I may.
We can do it however you want. Motion is in order. Commissioner Einhorn, do you want to jump in quickly?
I'm looking at section 2-7-43 of our code, of the city code, which is our prohibition on ex parte communication. I'm looking to see if we couldn't just lift that language.
That's what I was going to suggest.
It says, after a complaint has been filed and during the pendency of a complaint before, and we could just change the word complaint to appeal.
Yep.
Before the Ethics Review Commission, we could make it a subcommittee of the Ethics Review Commission. A member of the commission may not communicate directly or indirectly with any party or person about any issue of fact or law regarding the complaint except at a meeting of the subcommittee. This prohibition does not prohibit a communication by a city employee with the commission in the performance of the city employee's official duties.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'd agree with Commissioner Einhorn on that as well, and I think we maybe want to go through and just repeat exactly what we're doing, but I think we should be able to just pass the ordinance, this draft as it is, because this was notated on the agenda. The public was aware of it. I think those that were concerned obviously have shown up, seems like, without a whole lot to say just yet. But this was on the agenda. I know
they received a copy of the draft. Have y'all received a copy of it? Do you have any concerns with it?
I haven't read it. We just got it.
Well,
speed reading.
Keep reading.
And as long as you write,
we're just here to monitor. You're not going to get anything else.
I mean, understanding that we can bring this back next month and make revisions.
I plan
revise at any time. Unlike a department that has to go through the posting and comment period, this commission can revise its rules at any time.
And can we maybe make a motion to adopt these as interim rules pending any amendments and changes next month?
Yes, and spoiler alert, I plan to put this on the agenda regardless, because I think if for some reason someone else on the commission sees something that sticks out like a sore thumb, I want to make sure they've got a voice to it. So we're going to be agendized for it, even if we glaze over it in September.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Well, then I will wait for Commissioner Danberg's motion.
You go ahead and make it, because
I would move that we adopt this with this draft as written. With the sentence in B5, the second sentence in B5 struck, and the ex parte communication language
as discussed
from 2743 taken, you know, massaged for subcommittee of the Ethics Review Commission and appeal as opposed to complaint, inserted into the policy, and then we adopt it as an interim pending.
And
no.
can we go ahead and scratch that one sentence about the 5 days, the 5 business days? It's on page 4 under C, 6C.
Word
a party who
six.
Seeks additional time to present evidence must request additional time by five city business days prior to the appeal hearing. And that's
Commissioner Danberg, are you wanting to strike 5 city business days? Do you want to strike that sentence
just that
altogether?
One sentence?
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yep.
Is that okay with you, Peter?
Yes.
5 city days,
okay.
Business days prior to the appeal hearing, right?
Yeah.
Just that one sentence.
Okay.
Yes, that's part of my motion as well, right there.
Yeah. Just beginning with 5 city business days prior to the appeal hearing. So you still want a party who seeks additional time for the
party to
must request additional time, period.
Right.
Okay. So let's see.
A second.
So then the motion would be, with that change, would be a party who seeks additional time to present evidence must do so prior to the beginning of the appeal.
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's all I was suggesting, was just strike the 5 days.
Yeah, 5 city business days.
So that way, basically, all you're doing is you're putting in a floor. You're putting in a floor so that at the very least, they cannot, in the middle of a discussion, go, ha-ha, and throw something new out.
Yes.
They got to at least
so
bring
we'll
it to the table when they get there.
5 city business days.
Yeah.
But I think it syncs up with Commissioner Danberg's intent, which I strongly agree with. So
that's my
motion.
Okay,
so what you're saying is strike until must request additional time. I mean, keep.
We're going to keep the
keep
sentence.
That,
we're only
and then
striking
where it
5 city
starts with
business
5 city
days.
Business days, say prior to the beginning of the hearing?
Well, and it does, and right after that it says, must request additional time, mm-hmm. and then we're striking 5 city business days, and
that's
then
it.
It's mm-hmm. prior to the appeal hearing.
Right. What you're just all
yes.
you're doing is striking 5 city business
yeah.
days. And what you're essentially telling them is they have to come in and before the hearing starts to say, hey, I'm going to need some extra time because of XYZ.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay.
Is the motion clear? Striking that sentence
yeah.
in B5, and then striking those words in 6C.
Right, and then adding in the
ex parte communication prohibition.
Motion is understood by the chair, and in order, I think second, I'll give it automatically to Commissioner Danberg. all those in favor of the long-winded motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? Abstained? Passes unanimously. And I know I said it already, but just to be clear, I would appreciate staff if we could have that on the agenda for discussion next time, just regardless.
And I want to thank Lynn for so much work on this.
Thank
you, Lynn. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you.
They are rock stars.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay, that completes item 3. We completed item 4 at the beginning. Item 5, approval of minutes for the June 13th, 2018 regular commission meeting. I would entertain a motion accordingly. So moved by Commissioner Einhorn.
Second.
Seconded by Commissioner Soberon. Without objection, they are adopted.
I think we've already discussed future agenda items.
We sure have. Any other future agenda items? I just see Commissioner Einhorn down there. He's itching because Dennis isn't here. He wants to say.
In honor of.
He has a
high. I move a highly privileged motion.
Without objection, and no other discussion, the Ethics Review Commission August hearing is adjourned at 8:44 p.m.
Thanks, y'all.
If I want this.
Thank you for your patience.
With all my notes for the hearing in October, can I leave it in this or will it disappear if I leave it in this?